Welcome to a very different Old Frontline podcast this week, where, as you can hear, we're going to have some of the actual sounds of the First World War through two unique musical instruments that connect us to the Great War, to connect us to the pathways of the Western Front. And we're joined in this episode by historian, historical reenactor and musician Beverly Palin. And we're going to walk through and meet Beverly now as she continues to play her melodeon. Hello, Beverly.
Hello.
Hello. So, thank you for joining us on the Old Front Line. And that's not just any melodeon, is it?
That's Wilfred.
And Wilfred was once part of a battalion of the British Army.
It was local to me. He is actually a work in progress at the moment, researching them. I found him on eBay. There's a friend of mine tipped me off that there was he reenacts Durham Light Infantry, and he'd come up in just an eBay search for Durham Light Infantry memorabilia, and he's badged. If I just turn him over here, he's got a little.
There's two metal discs on there. One's the maker's name, I guess.
It's the maker's name, and though he was sold by J.F. Hiller's Piano and Organ Warehouse. That's in Sadler Street in Durham. Oh. And I went to university in Durham. I know exactly where that is. It's just coming straight off the marketplace. I think it's a homeless hostel now. I could be wrong. And there's another little plate, which is, it looks like it's been almost homemade, home engraved. It's been attached. DLI 18 Batten.
So that's the 18th Battalion Durham Light Infantry. And they were the Durham Pals, I think.
They were the Durham Pals. There's a group near me that reenacts the Durham Pals. But they were the battery that was stationed at Hough Battery.
Yeah.
The battalion, sorry.
And that's the near Hartlepool
bombardment. So it's interesting having that connection.
So that was an occasion in 1914, wasn't it, I think, where the German fleet came in and shelled
all up the northeast coast, and Hartlepool did actually fight back, and that's the only First World War battlefield on British soil.
And they actually lost men there as well, didn't they?
First Theophilus Jones, first British soldier to be killed on British soil in long enough, in action. It was a local school teacher, and I can't remember how many civilians, but. And the two men who went out to rescue Jones were killed as well. So, sad story. It was the day the war actually came to UK shores.
Yeah, an amazing story. And there was a battalion then that became part of the 31st Division, which is a unit we kind of equate with Sheffield City Battalion and the Accrington Pals and so on. And the Durham lads sometimes, I think, get a little bit lost in that story, but their path took them to Suez and then to the Somme. And this is a musical instrument that once may have been played in those kind of lanes of the Somme.
The actual research is very much a work in progress with them. And a pal of mine, Martin White, he's a fantastic restorer. And I don't have the gear to restore a free reed instrument myself. I'm not actually a melodeon player first and foremost. I've played accordion for years. I own a concertina, which at some point I'm going to start and learn to play properly. It's the little hexagonal version. That was a friend of mine's grandfather's. He passed it on because he's not a musician and his family aren't musicians. Another friend of mine actually owns, I think it's his great-grandfather's concertina, and that had all the provenance, and I'm sure it was on Malta. He said that he actually had newspaper cuttings of letters written back saying, please can we send out an instrument? And he's had, so, you know, I mean, again, just the story behind that. I don't know if he's still got it. I must ask him.
And this, I mean, if you look at the kind of establishment of a British battalion, it does have a band, but I don't know if a melodeon is part of that. Is this part of a musical tradition from the Northeast?
It's, well, it's part of the Northumbrian folk tradition, very much so. Probably the instrument that I've really made a career out of after the piano and the pipe organ is the Northumbrian pipes. The Northumbrian, certainly the Northumberland Fusiliers are the only regiment that I can think of that have Northumbrian pipers as well as Highland pipers. I mean, nobody else is really going to have them when you think about it. It's the only county in Britain that really has its own musical instrument like that. I know that there were Cornish great pipes. There were various other counties had their own instrument. They've mostly died out, and any examples that you see now tend to have been reconstructed. But they're in the Northumbrian pipes are in a really unusual tuning, and an absolute nightmare if you want to play with other musicians. But that's great if you're antisocial like I am. So they're not quite F. For those of you who play the clarinet, they're a transposing instrument. Everything is written in G and it comes out as F. So whatever you're playing comes out a note down. Why is beyond me. But it seems to exist purely to make life more awkward. But the tuning in a standard as it ever gets for the Northumbrian pipes is somewhere between F and F sharp. It's not quite F, it's not quite F sharp. And this melodeon is actually tuned pretty much to that. So I think it was actually made specifically for the Northumbrian folk market. It's actually German made. I see a friend of mine, Martin, lives in Essex, restored it for me because I don't have the gear to work with free reed instruments like that. And yeah, I mean, he's made a beautiful job, but he got inside it and found it, you know, and it was private purchase. It's probably been a cheap little instrument, pretty much like those plastic recorders that everybody's kids used to have. I mean, I can't be the only one who's tortured with three blind mice. And made around about 1900. So it's actually, it hasn't been a new one. It hasn't been bought for this newly formed battalion. There are records of the 18th Battalion of the TLI purchasing brass instruments for a band. No record at all of a melodeon being bought. So I think, because looking at that little plaque, it looks like somebody's engraved it with whatever the equivalent of Dremel was.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean,
it almost looks like something that should be on a presentation case or, mm-hmm. you know, almost perhaps strapped to a prize or something like that.
It's like something that something that my dad used to get on his Domino's trophies.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess the sound that this makes linked into the Northumbrian pipes is very much the sound of that kind of folk music from that part of Britain.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, we are distinct. It's, as far as folk music is concerned, Northumberland's a whole separate country. So it's not quite English. It's not quite Scottish. It's haven't come up through the folk scene in Northumberland. It actually has more similarities, to my mind, to the Irish folk. I believe that this has been bought fairly cheaply, and somebody has actually taken his old melodeon. Maybe he's taken a cheaper one if he's left a decent one at home even. And it's gone on its travels, and how it's been acquired by the battalion, I mean, has something befallen him? And the lads have thought, right, I'm hanging on to this. But there's nothing in the official... There's nothing in the official diaries, so it does make you wonder, is somewhere, it would be looking at the private diaries, and is somebody somewhere written, you know, also, and Dave got his melodeon out and we all threw our boots at him.
But it would have been a sound of home, I guess. That's how it kind of, I suppose, links us to the experience of soldiers on the front line, that escaping the realities of the war, they sought solace in something familiar, and this would have been familiar to them.
It would have been a bit of home. And I mean, I'll come on to that with the other instrument that we have. It's the familiarity aspect. But I think one thing that we do tend to forget is how ubiquitous music is nowadays. It doesn't matter where you are. You have music on in the car, you have the radio on in the background when you're pottering around the house, you walk into a shop, there's music playing in the background, there's background music and everything on the telly now. Does my head in that, but never mind. But music is everywhere. And just over 100 years ago, if you wanted music, you actually had to go and create it. And when I started off in the folk world, I worked with, was an elderly friend in the Northumbrian Piper Society who actually had some recordings. And I've never quite known how old they were, but there were recordings that were done on wax cylinders. Mm. I mean, and he had all the equipment for playing this. I would actually love to know where they've gone. Mm-hmm. But it was of a fairly famous fiddle player, Scott Skinner. So you think, I mean, even when you get into the portable gramophones, you still really got to make an effort for recorded music. I mean, I've got 78s in the house. Don't sit on my Jimmy Shands, thank you. And I mean, I can remember my grandfather when, you know, when the 33s and the 45s came in. God, I'm showing my age here, sorry. Taking the old 78s and used to soak them in water, turn them up and make a plant pot out of them. So, and you think these things were, they're quite big, quite chunky. I think taking those out of the trenches would have been an absolute nightmare, whereas an instrument, you can pop that in your pack.
Yeah, I mean, it's a convenient size, isn't it? We'll put a picture of it onto the podcast website. But, you know, I guess as well, with a recording of something, that is just a static recording, isn't it? You can only play that again and again, whereas with this, somebody could have called out the names of tunes that were favourites and, you know, almost like a request spot for the person who was the person playing it.
I mean, it's similar. It's from the same family as the harmonica. I mean, you think it's the harmonica you always associate with prisoners, cowboys and soldiers. And I play the harmonica as well. I haven't brought mine today. But I can always remember sitting, I was working at Carlisle Castle in First World War officer's uniform, Northumberland Hussars. Got myself sat on a windowsill in the education room, one leg dangling, just casually playing away to myself quite quietly. And there's a family came in and, oh, hello. And they jumped a mile. It was fantastic, but assumed it was piped music. But it always surprises people when they see a woman sitting playing the moothie. But that is, it's, we came from the same family. The advantage that you have here with a free reed instrument, the metal reeds, once they're tuned, they're fairly stable tuning. You think, I mean, you sort of get some quite extreme conditions. I think that's probably an understatement. When I'm playing the Northumbrian pipes, they're Spanish cane reeds. They don't like the heat. They don't like the cold, they don't like the damp, they don't like the dry, they don't like Mercury being in retrograde, they don't like the moon being on the wrong phase, they don't like the fact that your mother gave you a funny look slightly earlier. And sometimes you do want to kick them down the stairs. You just look at them funny and they will go out of tune. You can't take a violin out or a guitar for the same reason, apart from the fact that it's bulky. It goes out of tune. And you have issues, again, with conditions. One night when I was playing at, it was BBC Children in Need, and I was at Prudder Castle. I was playing the hurdy-gurdy, another stringed instrument, medieval mechanical fiddle. Those things are completely bonkers. And because it's the tuning pegs, because it was absolutely freezing that night, all the wood starts, the metal's shrinking and the tuning pegs were slipping constantly. So when we're trying to record, I'm having to tune the blasted thing every 5 minutes, and if you don't mind it slipped again, can we please, you don't get that with these reed instruments. The damp doesn't bother them. You drop them in a puddle, and I mean, let's face it, something like a harmonica, you've got to make a real effort to break it. I'm absolutely certain people did if the player wasn't much good.
So this is a kind of pick up and play instrument, really, which would have been perfect for the conditions of the Western Front.
It is. I mean, as long as it sort of gets a bit of basic care, as long as it doesn't get too damp. Don't set fire to it. Don't step on it.
No shrapnel.
It'll take pretty much anything. But I mean, I'd say my pal Martin made a fantastic job of the restoration, and we've actually left it. I mean, it gets a little bit of wood polish on it every so often, but we've actually left it as I think distressed, probably the word. It still looks like it's still a scruffy little thing. It was quite badly out of tune when I first acquired it, but yeah, it's
good. It's got that kind of great patina, as they often say on those antiques programmes, to it, which gives it that character. I mean, it's an amazing looking object, and the sound, you know, I think this is only one bit of the sound we're going to hear in this episode, but the sound already, to me, I can picture a kind of a smoky estaminet behind the lines on the Somme, and they've lost some mates up the line, and they're mourning for their fallen comrades, and they're thinking of home and what that means, and this kind of would transport them to home.
It would, and the tune that I chose to play there was a 9/8 pipe march, and to be honest, the chap's name escapes me now, but it was written by a pipe major in one of the Highland regiments. It's called Battle of the Somme, and he was killed a couple of months afterwards, and it does make you realise, we're recording this on the anniversary of George Butterworth's death. It actually makes you think how many musicians could have gone on, and not just musicians, how many creatives that could have gone on to amazing things had their lives not ended prematurely.
And music, as you said, is a big part of our lives now in a very different kind of way, but it was very much a part of that generation of the Great War, their lives, you know, with town bands and brass bands up here in Yorkshire, all the different collieries here would have had that kind of thing. Music was, you know, it was a part of the day-to-day existence and connected people to part of their lives, you know, I suppose in a way that, I mean, I'm not sure whether modern pop music does that, but this was the kind of certainly equivalent of something that could move ordinary people.
I mean, when you think communal singing unites people, and it doesn't matter what the context is, communal hymn singing was a big thing. Singing along the latest hits at the music hall. If you go to a pop concert, it doesn't matter who's up on stage. You know the lyrics. I mean, I'm a massive fan of Queen, and you think of the way when Freddie Mercury sang Love of My Life, and it became tradition that you always joined in with Love of My Life. And again, that's... If you're at a pop concert, you're all on the same side. Football chanting. Not a football fan. Went to a couple of matches, somewhat against my will. I thoroughly enjoyed the chanting. That's always entertaining. And that's, again, you're all on the same side. You're all behind your team. And it's that feeling with communal singing that suddenly you're one part of a much greater whole. And it bonds you. It's a real bonding thing.
And I remember the oral historian Lynn MacDonald say that she was once asked what connected her to the kind of the fields and the lanes of the Somme battlefields, which she'd just written a book about. And she said the music of the Great War, the songs, the communal singing, men marching down those roads, singing the songs that they knew, and sitting, as we've said, in the estaminets, and it's these kind of instruments that would have provoked that singing and made it possible.
Yeah, it's just having that, it's, you're having a bit of accompaniment there. If somebody whips a melodeon out, sorry, that should be a euphemism, Sean. Somebody whips them a melodeon out. You're gonna lead a sing along. If somebody doesn't have an instrument, that's not a trigger for it. So, and I mean, again, I think the melodeon is that says you're a little bit more serious about it. I think the most common instrument, and I'm kicking myself for not having brought it, would have been the harmonica or the jew's harp.
Mm. It's mentioned in a lot of kind of accounts of the war, and if you see kind of films of it. But I think to me, there's a richer sound in these. Maybe it's the kind of instrument that they are, which really, I think does transport us back to that period in a unique kind of way, really.
Yeah, it is rather special. And you just think, these instruments, they're the only voices. These are the only veterans of the Great War that still have their voices. Everything else is either written down or recorded, because the people that actually experienced it are gone. We can't ask them anymore. We can hear their voices in recordings, but they can't respond to us. And this is a voice from the Great War that not only speaks to us across the century, it can respond.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Really good point. And I think that kind of adds almost an entirely different kind of aspect to these as objects. They're not just tactile objects that we can, you know, examine and look at and hear. They are a voice, like you say, a voice of and a veteran. This, I mean, who knows where this has been?
Well, exactly. I would actually love to find out more about Wilfred's history. It would be now. I've exhausted the official alleys. He's not mentioned anywhere. Nobody has mentioned anybody having a melodeon. But we know what battalion he was in. There's got to be somewhere out there private diaries where somebody mentions in passing, oh yeah, and Private Smith had the melodeon. And
yeah, it's got to be in a letter or a diary or something, maybe even in some newspaper reports of those early periods it might be mentioned. So if anyone's listened to the podcast and has researched the 18th DLI and has come across a melodeon, we need to hear about it.
My friend was actually the curator of the DLI Museum, and this was before it was all packed away, but don't get me on about that. And apparently he says most of what he came across hadn't been digitised, still hasn't been digitised, and it's actually getting into those archives and seeing if there is anything relating that might possibly mention a melodeon, because I would love to find out. I know how he got acquired by the battalion, because he wasn't a military purchase. He wasn't actually bought by the battalion. It was an old tatty thing when he went off to war.
And here he is, an old tatty thing, all, you know, more than a century later. And
tattier with a slight whiff of mothballs.
But still, you know, just incredibly powerful to hear that. I mean, you've played one tune from it. I mean, what kind of other... Perhaps you could play this little segment of the podcast out with a kind of another kind of typical tune they might have heard in those smoky summer staminas.
Oh, I say, I'm not really a melodeon player. Just get caught on things here. But let's have a look. Snippet of Northumbrian folk tune. It's one called Jamie Allen, named after a piper in the 18th century who took a king's shilling and then legged it, as many of them did. And that's pretty much the first tune that every Northumbrian piper learns. And as I say, it's just appropriate, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is just an amazing sound. You know, I kind of I can close my eyes and I can imagine that kind of being played, and then as you ended it there, the lads all kind of raising their glasses and cheering. Yeah, exactly. You know, so it's fabulous. Like I say, I mean, I'm going to probably use the phrase unique a lot in this, but I just think that this is. It's just so extraordinary.
Well, so this, if you think of that little Venn diagram of professional musicians and Great War enthusiasts, there can't really be many in that middle section, can there? Yeah.
But again, it kind of shows how much we still have to learn about the Great War. And, you know, we often say about the last page of its history never being turned, and I think that's going to be true. But this kind of shows that there's so many layers to it, and this is another one of them, and they're all so important.
It is, and it's every time we explore a layer like that, and everybody has their own unique take that they can bring to the table. Everybody comes from their own place of experience. I mean, my background, like I say, I'm a professional musician, happened to be a Great War enthusiast. I'm thinking about these things as a musician, as a folk musician. And you can think about, I've written about Gustav Holst's experience. Great fan of Gustav Holst, love him dearly. Poor chap couldn't see past the end of his rifle, so that was the end of his service. We've mentioned George Butterworth, and other musicians that served, the classical musicians. Nobody really thinks about these, you know, the lads that were, let's say, sort of sitting, playing with folk instruments. You know, they're kind of at the down and dirty street level of music. They're the ones that sort of, you know, playing their very rude soldier songs and
making up the lyrics as they went along.
Because
every kind of tune gets adapted, doesn't it?
And everything gets adapted.
And once they've been through various experiences and seen the Mademoiselles and been up the line, all of that kind of culture that they're experiencing then, I guess, becomes part of their music.
It does. I mean, there's some very dark humour in these things. I was looking at the first... Where was it? I've told you about the Hearst song, haven't I? Famously recorded in... A chunk of it was recorded by the Pogues. And don't ever laugh as the hearse goes by, for you may be the next to die. Now we've got the worms crawling, the worms crawl out. Worms bleep binnacle on your snout. They eat your eyes, they eat your nose. Eat the jelly between your toes. And we see that. I see that as... It was a playground song. It's a classic case of something that was... It was first written down during the Crimean War. These guys are facing... They're facing death on a daily basis. How do the British cope with things that scare them? We laugh at it. We mock it. It's from the same school. Something that's started out as laughing at something that is actually quite scary, and it's sort of filtered down and turned into almost a nursery rhyme. It's from the same school as Hitler's Only Got One Ball.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. You're in this experience of adversity and you're trying to cope with it. And laughter and humour is one coping mechanism.
Well, it is. And I mean, there's some fantastic ones that I've seen parodies written on hymn tunes. I'll come back to that again when I'm not doing this. I'm an organist, a pipe organist. And again, there can't really be many others. If there are any others in the Great War enthusiast world, please do tell me, because I feel quite lonely sometimes. But there are a lot of parodies written on hymn tunes. We are Fred Connell's army, the ragtag military. And that's to, what the heck is that tune? That's a brilliant one. It's Wesley.
Onward Christian Soldiers, is that one?
The Church's One Foundation.
Right.
There's, we've had no beer. We've had no beer today. What's the use in living? Tell us, pray. We've had no beer is the subject of our lay. We've had no beer, no beer since yesterday. I feel like I'm at the cup final.
Well, that would have been the kind of eternal cry of soldiers, you know, as we've said a few times, I think, that it wasn't an army of choir boys, was it? These were rough, tough lads, and, you know, they put in all kinds of words as...
Exactly. I mean, if you look at what football chants are nowadays, that's probably going to be your nearest. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure there are probably a few weren't marching off to war singing hymns and madrigals, but there would have been not very many of them.
No.
So we've met Wilfred. We need to meet someone else now, don't we?
We need to go and see Reg.
So we'll go and see Reg. So we've come into the other room now, and we've got quite a large wooden box sitting here.
Doesn't really look much, does he?
It looks like something you know, possibly even carry ammunition in, or...
I mean, exactly, something like that turns up in your trench. You're not going to particularly think anything of it. It says it could be ammunition, could be supplies, could be some lovely hardtack biscuits. That's not... Let's hope not, anyway.
No. You don't want those teeth breakers.
So I used to, it's just as an aside, I've got a cutter for one of those things. I do like making fake tack. It scares the pants off people when you just bite straight into it. And yeah, I'm sure they didn't have pistachio and rose water in the trenches.
No, I'm sure they didn't.
So let's say it could be anything. It doesn't look much at all. I mean, it's quite heavy. I've carried it myself, but... Really, it's if you're going to be sensible about it, it's a two-man lift. It's got a sort of suitcase-type handle on the top, which has long since broken through. It's just sort of dangling there. I keep meaning to get it repaired. Haven't got round to that yet. But it doesn't really look anything, does it?
No, it could be anything. It could be a travel box, you know, luggage, you know, or any kind of purpose.
Something that... An officer's got his batman to move around.
Exactly, yeah.
So if I open those two little hinges there and flip that up.
Oh, wow.
Again, doesn't look all that exciting. A lot of bits of wood, all stacked up. Could be anything. And then I start lifting parts. So I'm lifting these two legs out either side. They're table legs. Got to admit, when I first acquired this, the legs were badly damaged. So I took what was left after the woodworm had done their job, cut round them to shape, took the metal fittings off and added them. I have not varnished this to tone in with the rest of it. These are replacements. I've made it clear that these are replacements. So then I lift this bar up. Funny looking thing.
They look like kind of pedals, are they?
There we are. Two little pedally, paddly things. A couple of spits of webbing. Yeah. Don't think it was, you know, if we all know what I'm like for webbing.
Yeah. And it looks military, the webbing as well, doesn't it? It kind of...
It is.
It reminds me of some of the kind of bits of kit that you see that officers had
something
that were homemade.
Like the Sam Brown stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So all I do is I slide this bar onto these clips here. And then suddenly we've got something that looks a little bit more tabley. If I slip that back in, it braces the two legs apart. And there's a little hook either side. The original hooks have disappeared. These are modern ones. And all I need to do now is tape hold of the side and flip it over.
Oh. So now it's standing up on those two supports.
So it's standing up on those two supports, and again you can see there's two pedals in the bottom.
Right.
Now the musicians here will be pricking their ears up. I think we'll have to put some photos of this on, Paul.
We will, definitely, yeah. It's amazing looking already, and you haven't opened the best bit of it.
And obviously just realised it really needs a clean as well. I do a lot of schoolwork with this, and it could... Could have been anywhere. And then...
So it's got like a hinged lid now.
And then you've got a hinge sort of halfway across. So all I need to do there is lift that top, and there's a little bit of magic.
That's the keys.
Piece of leather either side. And you think, again, let's say, if this appeared in your trench, you wouldn't think anything of it. But you set that up, and you set it up so... It takes so little to set it up. And there's a bit of home. There's a bit of magic there. So, and it's something that, when you think that if people have only had, instrument-wise, if they've had the melodeons, the concertinas, the harmonicas, something like this, it's sort of, we've just moved up a step up the scale here.
So there's a manufacturer label I can see on there. R.F. Stevens, is there?
R.F. Stevens Limited, established 1853.
Kelly Street, Kentish Town.
That's it. So if I take these two pedals, if you see this underneath here, that's a Bellas. And it works exactly the same as a piano accordion, or indeed the melodeon that I've just been playing. It actually works slightly differently to the melodeon, in that it's the same note whether I'm pushing or pulling on the bellows. A melodeon manages to fit more notes into a smaller space because the reeds go in opposite directions to each other. So if I pull one way, it's one note. If I push in, it's a different note. Again, having originally learnt to play the accordion, it's the same note in or out, the melodeon was a real shock to the system. I haven't completely got my head around that yet. But this, again, because it has a piano keyboard, is pretty much the same as... It works exactly the same as a horizontal accordion. So there we go, there's your Jimmy Shands coming out again. Yeah. Hey.
So what this is then is a trench organ.
It's a trench organ. These things were issued to the chaplains... most famously, Toby Clayton had one, and that's the sibling to this. The portable organ, because he had a compulsory church service on a Sunday. If you're behind the lines, there wasn't really any chance of opting out of this. Certainly, there would have been a level of peer pressure, and I think again, nowadays, churchgoers do tend to be in the minority. I mean, I'm not actually practicing religious, yet I work for the Church of England as an organist. That's where organs are. You don't tend to find them many places outside churches now. But there would have been, it was much more a part of life. And I suppose really it was whether or not you had any religious beliefs, you went to church, end of, on a Sunday. So having these church services wasn't necessarily, I believe, just for the whole sort of spiritual fulfilment thing, although again, I think anybody that's facing death on a regular basis is going to think about their immortal soul a little bit more than maybe the rest of us do. It's a bonding thing. It's exactly the same as your football chants, your pop concerts, everybody's singing on the same side. I mentioned football chants there. We mentioned Abide With Me and the parody lyrics to it. Abide With Me is still sung to this day at the cup final. And I would say out of the funerals that I play for at work, I'm a funeral specialist, I love a good funeral, the funerals that I play for at work, I would say it's still at least probably about 75% of them, Abide With Me is one of the hymn choices.
So this is a bit of kit kind of for a chaplain for religious services, but it's kind of much more than that. Like you say, that the men may not have been. I mean, it was a generation that was arguably more religious than most people today. But there was the community aspect of it, like you've said, the community participation and singing of familiar hymns would have kind of removed you from the reality of where you were in a place like the Western Front.
I mean, you think even familiarity nowadays, I'm 44. I'm of the generation that still sung hymns in school assembly. We all remember those. And, you know, that sort of come and sing hymn book. we all know those school assembly bangers. My daughter at 11 doesn't know them because they don't sing hymns in assembly anymore. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing isn't for me to say. But the time was when if you went to any school in the country, they were using the same hymn book and everybody would know the same hymns. That was a thing that you would have in common. You could sing along to the hymns in assembly when you moved to a new school. That even if these people had been to different churches, they could still join in with the hymns. It was a bonding thing.
And again, familiar music to them through their own lives of being in communities where the church was a part of it, or, you know, if they'd have worked in collieries and factories and so on, there was still a kind of religious aspect to that, which they would have attended services on, you know, days connected to religious festivals, even if that was just Christmas. Mm-hmm. So it is a familiar echo of home. Again, isn't it?
I mean, even if you weren't especially a churchgoer, I mean, I live in a relatively small town, and you know, maybe a generation behind as far as that sort of social aspect of it's concerned, we still make a big thing of christenings. It's not even necessarily a religious statement. It's the naming of the child, the welcoming of the child into society. And guess what? You have a couple of hymns. Whenever there's weddings, there's slightly less of those nowadays, but when there's weddings, there's a couple of hymns. There's always a couple of hymns at funerals, and it's something that unites everybody. So even if you're not setting foot in a church any other time, even Christmas or Easter, you're still having those big life milestone services that you're going to, that for friends, for family, for neighbours.
And we see that, I think, filter through as well, the importance of hymns and church music, in inverted commas, filters through to the inscriptions on the headstones, which many of them are drawn from familiar hymns.
The reference and hymns?
Yeah.
It's what people know. It's a handle on... It's on familiarity, it's a bit of home.
So the padre could himself play this, but often he would have an assistant.
I mean, again, that depends. I mean, I think certainly there would have been padres that were capable of playing this themselves. I've worked with vicars who have actually played their own evensong and run back and forward between the pulpit and the organ. I wasn't there, but I have had the stories. But now you would get somebody would be pulled out of the congregation, the audience, and right, you had some piano lessons at home, up you get. And if you were unlucky, you might get somebody who's going to struggle to find middle C and is going to pick out a hymn accompaniment very slowly with one finger. These things happen. You don't know what you're going to get, but if you're lucky, you might latch on to somebody who could actually play and knew what they were doing. And that comes back to why this instrument is, why we named him Reg, after your friend Reg.
Reg Glenn, yeah. He was in the 12th Battalion, York and Lancaster Regiment, Sheffield City Battalion, or the Sheffield Powers, as they're often called, who came from a fairly middle-class background in Sheffield before the war, could play the piano. He often said that the Sheffield City Battalion was formed of 1,000 of the best men of Sheffield and him, which was typical of the way he kind of, you know, a bit of self-depreciation on his part, but he was an amazing guy. And after the attack at Serre on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, and having seen, being in the signal section, he went forward and saw men fall all around him. The padre asked for someone to play exactly this, to play the trench organ, and that's how he came to be the padre's organist. And that led you to name this amazing piece of history after Reg Glenn.
So it's, and every time I take Reg into schools, I tell Reg Glenn's story. And I think that's all we can really do for those lads now, tell their story. That's, you know, they can't tell it themselves. And I'd like to think part of him lives on wherever he is. I'd like to think he's smiling because he did talk lovingly about playing the trench organ.
He did, yeah. And it wasn't a kind of a dodge. I mean, he never kind of explained it in that way. That, you know, perhaps you think, well, you get light duties and that kind of stuff. But being the padre's friend, being the padre's organist, meant that you had to accompany the padre when he was doing non-organ-related duties, which included, of course,
the burial parties.
Burial parties, looking for the dead, dealing with the wounded and things like that. And some of Reg's kind of most potent memories was of searching for the dead at Seir once the Germans had withdrawn and finding those shattered bodies of the men of Sheffield who he'd grown up with and lived with and drunk with and played with as children. And there they were, skeletal remains left on the battlefield.
It's a tattered remains of what once was a man. And it's so Reg Glenn's had maybe a slightly different kind of hell, but yeah. I'd like to think he took some comfort from having the ability to play music, because, I mean, having experienced depression myself, and I also suffer from PTSD, it's something that I have often found solace in, just switching off and playing to myself. And you can lose yourself in that world with music. And I do hope Reg found some light in the dark place.
Well, today we talk about music therapy almost, don't we? And I suppose to the men of that generation, men like Reg sitting here playing an instrument like this and the men listening, let's hope it was some kind of therapy for them in the kind of circumstances they were in. You know, the Great War wasn't always terrible every day, but once you've fought in a battle and you've lost mates, as they did in that Sheffield City Battalion, for example, maybe this was the way that somehow it would almost, the sound of this, maybe gather the ghosts.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you think life is so transient, and it must have been so clear to them. And one thing I'm conscious of as a musician is that when I'm playing, when I'm performing, I don't have anything concrete to hold on to afterwards to say, look what I made. I throw my heart and soul out into the audience, and sometimes I don't get anything back. Whereas a plumber can look at what he's created that day and say, look what I've done. Because now their sink works. A carpenter can look at what he's made. There is nothing concrete that I can put my hands on and say, I created this today, that my hands are still as empty at the end of the day as they were at the start of it. But I've created music, and it is so transient. And I think it does actually remind us how fleeting life can be.
I think you're absolutely right, yeah.
You must have been very, very conscious of that.
Yeah, because they had no certainty of a tomorrow, did they, in some respects, that particularly after they'd been in an attack like the Somme, seeing how random death was, that you never knew whether the next day...
Nothing was coming for you.
No.
It does make me wonder, you know, when you, again, just when you mentioned there, the 18th Battalion of the DLI, did Reg Glenn ever meet Wilfred?
Well, yeah, same division. And there were these multi-kind of battalion concerts, weren't they, behind the lines, where they took over, then moved into a village and took over a big barn, and a few of them who maybe knew each other because of their connection through music, you know.
And musicians will find each other anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to work with a drummer that wherever he went, he would find another drummer. And we reckon that he used to sniff them out or something, all that. But musicians will find other musicians. And then if somebody gets an instrument out and starts to play it, ears would prick up all over the place. And, you know, if Reg didn't have access to his trench organ, if he'd heard a melodeon on the go, he would have been there like a shot.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, and again, this is something that we know so little about. You know, were there these groupings of musicians who met each other by chance in these villages behind the lines or in the trenches of the Western Front, and then they create their own kind of little groups to perform to the soldiers?
I mean, it's so, again, it is so ephemeral, so transient. I mean, how many times have I played at a session in a pub, had a fantastic evening with people who for that evening were friends for life, and then you never see them again, and it was there and it was gone, and I didn't write anything down to say that happened, and that memory will die with me, and that's actually, in some respects, that's actually okay.
Mm. And the thing with veterans, when they come back from conflict, when they meet up, the survivors meet up, the things that they talk about isn't what it was like to be wet in the trench or hear the whistle blow and go over the top. The things that they remember are those moments of humanity where they're listening to music, singing with their mates.
It's singing rude songs set to hymn words.
Yes, that's what they remember, definitely.
That's your "What a Lovely War" sort of concept, isn't it? They're going to talk about the fun bits. And no matter how... Yeah, I mean, the British squatty is a resourceful breed. No matter how dire the situation, somebody's going to find some humour in it and try to lighten everybody else's spirits. And that's the bit that they're going to remember. And maybe in some respects that has sort of watered down the horror of it.
Maybe. And this has its own. I mean, you've played this for us once on a podcast supporters evening, I seem to remember. You know, it could not possibly do justice to it. So the sound of it, I remember when you first sent me a recording of you playing it, I was transfixed by it, because to me it kind of almost epitomises an element of the Great War experience. So I'm sure we'd love to kind of hear something from Reg.
Well done. There's a couple of little knee stops here.
Those two little metal bars.
So again, if I just get that going, you can just about hear that squeaking sound there. I mean, he's very old, so he's allowed to be a little bit wheezy, isn't he?
We're all a bit squeaky.
So if I'm to sort of press a chord there, it works almost like the pipe ranks on a pipe organ. I can change the sound here because there are multiple ranks of reeds. So if you can imagine, it's like if I put extras on, it's like blown three harmonicas at the same time, and they all have a slightly different sound. Some of them are tuned an octave higher, so you're getting that sort of pair of notes coming out. So, and it's just, I'm just quite aware that my trousers are a little bit tighter than they should be at the moment. We're just going into cello player mode here. So if I press, that is the basic sound of it. If I pop this stop on, which I'm pushing this bar outwards with my knee, it's not an instrument to play in a short skirt. In the same chord here, now it's got if I was using a pipe organ, that would be an oboe tone. It is a little bit quacky, isn't it?
Mm.
Everything is either a duck or not a duck. And then I can begin, that's the regular, and that's with that octave on. So I can put all three on together.
Wow. such a rich sound. I mean,
it's spine tingling, isn't it?
It's incredibly moving, you know, kind of to think that this, I mean, who knows, just like Wilfrid, we don't know where Reg went during the Great War, but who knows where that sound echoed.
I mean, you think that's been the last music that some of those lads have heard.
Yeah.
And when you start to think about it, it really is, like I say, spine tingling. I actually bought Reg in, would have been about 07. And I was on holiday with my then husband in Lyme Regis. And it was in a little junk shop. I picked it up and I thought, well, because I do a lot of funerals. So I work for the Church of England and I can go all over the place. I sub for a few local churches. I am the ecumenical matter. I play for anybody that's paying me. But when I'm playing funerals, sometimes I'll end up in a little church that doesn't necessarily have much of an electricity supply. There's no useful power points for a keyboard. Or sometimes if I'm playing in crematoria, there's not much of a place to put an electric keyboard. It's not necessarily all that convenient for running an extension for the electricity. And I thought, this thing is going to make my life so much easier because it's entirely off leg power. And yet I do end up with thighs of steel by the end of a service. Sometimes I'm a little bit sore, but it's, I bought it purely for the convenience. And it sat for long enough just being gigged. And it all came out on Twitter, or indeed whatever the heck we'll call it at the minute. That this thing's, I'm just looking here. I'm actually mortified that I ended up having to use a couple of Phillips screws there just to keep the blasted thing held together, because it was terrible with woodworm when I got it. And I shoved a couple of screws in, intending to replace them with something a little bit classier. So yeah, that's probably not a good look, and I should sort that out.
Reg is a work in progress, I think we'll call him.
Reg has been probably a work in progress for the last 100 years. Again, at some point, I'm going to have a road trip to Essex for my pal to have a look at the reeds. But I've done the cosmetic work myself, got him into work and order, and let's say it was quite happily doing the rounds of the local funerals. And then, you know, he wasn't particularly being used for anything else. Wasn't that sort of sure about his background. I say, like, oh yeah, trench organ, military, yeah, that's cool. Now, I'd always been interested in the Great War, and I think anybody of my age, I know it's become fashionable to sneer at Blackadder and, you know, the whole Lions Led by Donkeys thing, but yeah, we're no different now. It was the handle for a lot of us getting interested in the Great War. And at 11-year-old, I fell in love with the uniforms. And I begged my mother, who was a tailor, to make me a Blackadder outfit. And she refused because she didn't like the idea of me cross-dressing. So it took me 30 years, but I got one eventually. But as I say, so I had this sort of mild interest in militaria. I used to like playing at soldiers with my cousins, who were boys. But as long as I got to be the cavalryman on my bike, we've all done it, haven't we?
Most definitely, yeah.
So when it's military, that's cool. Didn't particularly think anything of it until it came out via Twitter, what I actually had and just how unique it was. I was talking to a friend of mine that I'd seen quite a lot of him in 2014. He'd been working on some of the stuff for the centenary, and we'd lost touch for one reason or another. Didn't actually see each other again until we got back in touch because of you, Paul, and indeed because of Reg in 2018. I'm glad he did get back in touch. That was quite a thing as a result of that. I've had a remarkable few years as a result of Reg being around, getting some interesting places, met some amazing people. And yeah, but let's say this lad, my friend actually said that was there long enough when I was visiting you 4 years ago. Why didn't you say anything? Because I didn't actually know just how unique it was. And it was just, you know, there it was. It's, you don't really want to look at my work gear, do you?
No. And here you have this unique piece of history,
and
which, like you say, is a veteran of the Great War in its own right, and is a voice of that war, and a voice that, as we've heard, still speaks so movingly.
And people have said how emotional they find that. Now, I've got to admit, this sounds terrible. I've actually getting a little bit blasé because this is part of my working gear. Nowadays, he's actually still part of my working gear. I still do funerals on him. And I do a lot of schools work now, which, I mean, again, that is a privilege in its own right. That is a tremendous thing. But, you know, Reg gets all over the place. And what I think one of the most profound moments of the centenary in 2018 was being asked to play for the Festival of Remembrance at Durham Cathedral. Now, I'm also a reenactor, historic interpreter. I say I've got my officer's uniform, Northumberland Hussars. I'm very conscious that, I mean, we've always had cross-dressing female reenactors in all sorts of periods, but I've never actually seen another one in 20th century military. English Civil War, Vikings, medieval, you name it. There's always been girls on the battlefield because guess what? We like swinging swords around. We really like it. And I did debate because, I mean, really, most female Great War reenactors that you see, they tend to be either civvies or nurses. That's the only real options that I've seen. And because I'm interested in the weaponry, I'm a swordsman, I do historic European martial arts. I really wanted to be able to use that expertise in weaponry as part of my character. And I was in a position where it wouldn't have been realistic for a female character to have done that. So I chose to play a male, but I was very conscious that it could be taken the wrong way, it could be seen as taking the mickey. And that was the last thing I wanted. So I do try to play that character as respectfully as possible. James, my character, is quite funny, really, because he started off as sort of somewhere between Lieutenant George and Lord Flashheart. And he's kind of slowly morphed into Ewart McIntosh, hasn't he? Just because I worry about the boys terribly, and you know, you were only their fathers, but I was their officer, darling.
And you find that young people respond to that.
And young people respond to that. And I think it's I've done a lot of, I say when I do a lot of work in schools, a lot of work at museums. We've worked at the Devil's Porridge Museum up in Annan. We've worked at Hough Battery. We've worked at the wonderful Blythe Battery. I adore working there. And just actually having somebody to speak in first person. So it's remembering to stay very much in character. Not they went over the top, we went over the top. Bizarre, all they really want to know is what my horse is called. Talisman, by the way. But, you know, just actually to stay in character like that. And sometimes you'll get a group that's just of the right sort of age that can suspend their disbelief. And you've taken them back there. They've experienced it. I think I've had to make a little bit more effort than most male reenactors have had to. I mean, to be honest, most of the male historic interpreters that I've seen, a lot of their kit is absolutely immaculate, spot on, beautifully done. I mean, I think the khaki chums are just absolutely incredible. I mean, that's a sort of benchmark, really. But if you, I've had to make a little bit more effort than your average reenactor, because, you know, is a crossdresser going to be taken seriously?
But I think also you kind of presented a good female role model to young people to say that history is not just about blokes for blokes, that history cuts across all those kind of boundaries.
Exactly. I mean, it's not a boys only field. And there's always been women in military history. I mean, you talked about Lynn MacDonald, Rose Coombs. There have always been women in military history. And, you know, I mean, I'm thinking even one of my favourite, going to an earlier period, one of my favourite military history paintings ever, The Return, Lady Butler Henderson. This was, you know, it was a female artist there, and in some respects, yeah. I mean, I'm not a trailblazer here. I'm following in the footsteps of people that came before me.
Yeah, and often they kind of did groundbreaking work. You know, some of the people you've already mentioned kind of added new dimensions to our understanding of this subject, the Great War, in a way that others had not.
I mean, when I first got interested in this, it was very much military histories for the boys. And if the internet had been around back then, yes, I am that old, shut up. If there had been the internet back then, I might have gone in a whole different direction because, I mean, as it was, my degree was archaeology. I became an Egyptologist. There's no money in it, don't do it. But I do wish that... maybe I'd known about the opportunities. But, you know, I mean, I came from a small town in Northumberland.
But you've created your own opportunities because, you know, by bringing the likes of Wilfred and Reg together and doing what you do with historical reenactment and all the other work that you do, you and Dr. John Sadler, you mentioned...
I mean, John's amazing.
And we'll put a link to your website and your Facebook page so people can find you there. If you're doing an event and you want these two amazing people to come and speak to your group, speak to your students, you know, get in touch with them. But you've created something that is just incredible by using the sounds and these voices of the Great War through music to tell a story.
I mean, I was interviewed a lot over the centenary, particularly in 2018, about Reg and about the work that I do. And really, our generation have seen the Great War pass from memory into history. And there are very few people left. I think Richard Van Emden, who's been on your podcast, has found some... Yeah, it was some very elderly people that only just remembered the armistice. There was a very elderly lady who was interviewed on our local news who only just remembered the armistice, about 5 year old. And they're gone, and someday the last person that remembers will die, and that'll be it. A thread will snap, and that's it. And probably without flying a flag or ringing a bell, it's gone.
Yep.
The last little light's gone out. And because, I mean, you know, we think of the last three British veterans died in 2009.
Mm.
And yeah, so it's there's only just that tiny glimmer of living memory. But see, we've seen it going into history. And I remember when I first started playing the Northumbrian pipes at some county events, there were still a couple of Great War veterans would attend. And of course, they're all gone now. My daughter hasn't had that opportunity. She's hardly going to remember Second World War veterans. They're all gone. I was even talking to, I was speaking at a retired gentleman's club in Jesmond a few weeks ago. And some of the old fellas there, they were in their 80s, but they were very proud National Service boys. And I thought, well, the last of the National Service boys are going to be in their mid-80s now. That's another thing that's just going to slip into history and it's hardly going to be noticed. And really, you just think there's that change. And something just goes from something that's almost fluid, that's being remembered, that's being spoken about by people that were there, into something static, that everything that's been, everything that can be written down has now been written down. Every memory that can be shared has been shared. That's it. It's become finite and we've now got a finite source to work from. And really, the historians, the enthusiasts, even the poor reenactors, we have been the midwives of that change. We've carried it, and it has been our responsibility to have made it an easy birth.
Yeah, I think that's a really good analogy, actually, because we are in a new world now. You know, it's without that generation. I think, you know, the people that you refer to who are still with us, I think, have probably got to be the children of men who died, who have got to be. I mean, it's the 110th anniversary of the outbreak of war next year. You know, so we're talking, and I think Richard Van Emden is still in touch with at least one of those. But once that's gone, like you say,
that's it.
But that's why this is Reg and Wilfred and the work that you do with younger generations who will never get to hear that except in recordings. They can hear things like this and it
makes it real.
Yeah. And it's something they won't forget because of the power of music, I think, you know, and how music affects all of us as humans, as it has affected humans ever since the first musical instrument was ever made.
I mean, the most powerful experience that I had with Reg was in 2018. And we had the tremendous privilege of being at the Festival of Remembrance. Was a Major Eric Ingram, he was Scots Greys, organised it for years. He's retired now, but again, fantastic chap. And myself with John Sadler and another chap, Tony Hall, a couple of others, were asked in 2017 to attend in the First World War uniform as reenactors. And we ended up with sort of, you know, we formed an escort to the Chelsea Pensioners, which was, and as the Chelsea Pensioners came paraded down the aisle at the end of the service with us afterwards, they got a standing ovation, and there was this almost like a Mexican wave, this ripple as they came down the aisle, and that was beautiful. And then of course as the poppies fell from the ceiling, and I hadn't quite expected it in 2017, and we stood for the minute silence, and I just heard whoosh, 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 whoosh. And of course I'm thinking, what the heck's that? I glanced across at my colleague John, and he was just stood there and whoosh, 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 whoosh. And then something dropped on his shoulder. What the heck? He didn't move. He didn't flinch. And I look, there's something red. And of course, you know, in the minute silence here, you don't want to particularly start poking anybody. I think, what the heck's that? And then another one and another one. And I looked up, and the poppies just slowly started to fall. And it's quite high. You know, it's this Durham Cathedral. And just seeing them slowly drifting down, well, I was weeping buckets, wasn't I? So 2018, Major Ingram asked us to play Reg. And who has, you know, musical performances. And I played, was in front of the road screen, just at the top of the nave. And John and I carried Reg out, only brought my chair, sat them down in silence. The lads went back to their seats and I played Nearer My God to Thee, which I've just played for you, and Abide With Me. Now, I wasn't mic'd up at all. I wasn't amplified. The people at the back of the cathedral heard every note. It was absolutely incredible. It was one of those things where you don't actually quite realise the gravity of what you've just done until you step off. And I sat down, it was, you know, you just think, whoa, what just happened here? Another friend of mine, a lad called Paul Kingston, that when the actual story went, because it went viral on Twitter, and Paul, honestly, I have to thank you for having held my hand right the way through that, because I felt like I was fending off journalists for about 3 weeks. It was an amazing opportunity to actually tell Reg's story. And in some respects, I felt like I was carrying the story of that generation. You know, you're bringing awareness of what those lads did, what they went through, it's humanising them. They were just ordinary people. They like to listen to music just like we do. There's just such a tendency to think of people of the past as almost a different species, and they were just us in different clothes.
And it's these layers, I think, that make us realise that the Great War is not just about bombs, bullets and bayonets. It's kind of about so much more. It's the human experience of it all.
As I say, so many people have actually said that they found it far more emotional than they expected. They found the sound really has touched something deep inside them. And one lady came up to me after it, and she said, I was packing away. And very quietly she said, do you mind if I touch it? And I said, no, I says, I can get it out. I says, you can have a look. You're quite welcome to have a try if you want to. She said, no, she said, I just want to touch it. And she patted it very gently with her fingertips like you would a small dog. And she looked at me and, sorry, I'm welling up here. She had tears in her eyes and she said, my grandfather was killed on the Somme. Wow. And then she just turned and left. And I thought, well, I don't know who the lady was. Even less do I know who her grandfather was. Her grandfather would have heard one of these things.
Yeah.
And again, that could have been the last music he would have heard. And it just connected her. It just touched something in her soul that connected her to that man. It's a beautiful thing, and it's just such a privilege to be Reg's current custodian.
And shall we end then, I think, with Reg speaking to us once more? Through you, of course.
Through you. It's the organ grinder and the monkey, isn't it, buddy?
It's a lot more than that. I think it's amazing work that you do, and I think people listening to this will be amazed by this.
I mean, again, I honestly, this thing has really, I mean, I can't, for myself, this has been a sort of life-changing thing. And as I learned more, and as I, realised that actually, if I want to study this, there's nothing stopping me. If I want to get interested in it, and guess what? I can actually have my Blackadder outfit after all.
Yeah.
My mother felt a little bit happy about it nowadays.
And you can make, the access to history approachable and accessible to inspire these new generations.
And it's such a remarkable thing. It's a tremendous responsibility that I'm able to do this. But it's a great privilege as well. And, I'm telling their story. That's all we can do for them now.
And it's a privilege to have you on the podcast and Wilfried and Reg speaking to us all. So we're over to you, Reg. Well, thank you, Beverly, for joining us, and thanks for all that you do. And it's amazing that the voices of Reg and Wilfred live on, and long may they continue.
You've been listening to an episode of The Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCor. You can follow the podcast at Old Front Line Pod. Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me A Coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Links to all of these are on our website. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.